A new play at the Unicorn delves into gender identity. It's a comedy, so, like, it's funny, but it's also serious. The name of the play is Here, spelled H-I-R.
Here is an alternative pronoun, which my character, Max, who identifies as genderqueer, uses instead of any sort of gendered pronoun.
That's Ahafia Yurkovich-Miles, one of the actors in the play, giving an informal lesson in gender pronouns via YouTube.
It's neutral, just like I use the pronoun they, them as a singular pronoun. Max uses Z and here. So instead of saying he was going to the store, you would say Z was going to the store. Or if you were to say, oh, that's his, you would say instead, oh, that's here's. These pronouns are difficult even for me, I promise.
Ahafia has a lot of personal experience with this stuff, so that's no small confession, and it's also what makes the casting of Ahafia as Max a big deal. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today we're talking about roles for genderqueer actors, how to get used to new pronouns, and a whole lot more with Ahafia Yurkovich-Miles. Hi, Ahafia.
Hi.
So first, can you give a quick synopsis of this play at the Unicorn?
Yes, I can try. It's a pretty crazy show. Basically, it's a kitchen sink family drama. We've got four characters who are basically on stage the whole time. There's the mother, Paige, and the father, Arnold. Arnold used to be the head of the household. He was very particular and rather abusive. And now that he has had a stroke, Paige has really taken control of the house and tried to reassert her life in the way that she wants it to be, which is very much fueled by her youngest child, Max, who is transgender and genderqueer and is kind of reinventing the world around here because Z really needs to get out of this abusive household that they've lived in the whole time. So Paige is taken on the coattails of Max and just expanded these ideas to the max and is really trying to take back her own authority.
Really inspired by her child.
Yes, yes, so much so. And Isaac, the eldest child, has just come back from 3 years in Afghanistan in the mortuary affairs. So he's seen a fair amount of stuff and he hasn't really heard anything about what's going on at home. He knew that his father has had a stroke, and he's coming back to help with that. But he doesn't know about Max transitioning. He doesn't know about how Paige has taken the house kind of apart, turned it on its head, taken every bit of order, and made it her own chaos.
Well, yeah, order that had been I've read this script, or yeah. This, a lot of it, and order that had been imposed in the form of, like, household tidiness and stuff, and
yes.
Now pages like anti-things having places.
Yes, there's just clothes everywhere. Nothing's in cupboards. The kitchen table isn't in the kitchen anymore. And nothing's clean, really. And Arnold now, she just kind of treats as like a pet in a way. Like she dresses him up in makeup and wigs and he sits around in a nightgown all day. And when he says something that she doesn't like, she squirts him with a squirt bottle.
So this, I have to admit, I mean, having read, I understand what's funny about the play,
yeah.
But it doesn't sound funny.
It doesn't at all. It's very much a black comedy. But it is funny. Like, I was surprised, especially once I got into the room with the other three actors and reading through it, I was like, oh my gosh, these jokes are so snappy and good. And reading it, like, you get the sense of that because Taylor Mack's writing is so active, so propelled. You feel the energy like through the words. But once you're saying them back and forth to each other, you can tell like it's got a rapport to it that's infectious. And you can't help but laugh sometimes. And oftentimes because it's so surreal, you can't believe what's happening.
Can you tell me more about your character, Max?
Yeah, okay. Max is 17, so in the prime of the rebellious stage, basically. And Z has started taking testosterone to transition. Now, Max doesn't identify as binary trans. So Z is not transitioning to the ultimate goal of presenting and identifying as a cisgender man. Rather, Z is genderqueer, which for Max is never really truly defined except for the label transmasculine, which Z uses later on in the show, which is more if you're thinking about gender on a spectrum between like male and female, obviously there's all this stuff in the middle of the spectrum. So it's maybe leaning more towards the masculine side but not identifying as male. So for instance, Max, my character, wears a binder because Z probably has some dysphoria around her breasts. And now that Z has been on testosterone for probably the better part of a year, Z has a bit of a beard, which Isaac remarks upon instantly because he's just like, whoa, 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 wait, you're supposed to be my baby sister. But like, that's not who Max is anymore. And Max loves to educate and shock with this new knowledge. Z has gathered up all of this new exciting information about her culture as a queer trans person, and Z wants to tell the world about it, and Z really wants Isaac to come back and accept her for who Z is, because it's obvious from the script that Max and Isaac were close. They care for each other deeply, and I think Isaac acted a lot as a protector before he left for Afghanistan, especially in such an abusive, controlling household. And so Max's dearest wish when Isaac comes back is that he's going to accept Max for who Z is. And almost instantly, there's some pushback. And so Max kind of acts out and pushes back by throwing a lot of this new knowledge in his face. But it's not usually in like a mean way. It's usually in a way that like Z is trying so hard to get Isaac to understand. And like I empathize with that a lot, because for me, like, the education aspect of activism is so important. I always try to make sure that people feel like they can ask me about trans issues, because I know that it's like a big old scary world of like stuff you don't know.
Well, yeah. And this is something that you relate to personally, which we haven't fully established yet. And I want to ask you about that. How do you relate to Max? Like, what is the personal story that you bring to Max's story?
Okay. So I also identify as trans and genderqueer. I was assigned female at birth. I was on testosterone for about half of a year when I was 18. And I got to a point where I just felt comfortable with the body that I was in. My voice had deepened. My body type had changed a little bit. And I was like, okay, this is comfortable for me. I don't want to be on testosterone for the rest of my life. And I've always identified as genderqueer in a way, even if I didn't have a word for it, you know, as a kid, because you don't really. And this is a newer thing. Like, our generation is really the one who is starting to use these labels. And it was actually my mother who started using they, them pronouns for me, and I got really comfortable with those really quickly.
How did that happen between you and your mom, that she had the understanding that allowed her to lead the way?
We talked about pronouns a fair amount, and she wasn't really comfortable using male pronouns for me. And from the beginning, I was like, I'm comfortable with using he, him pronouns or they, them pronouns. Like, either is fine. And she was like, okay, well, they, them is a little bit easier for me. And as she was using those more, I realized more and more that that was even more comfortable for me than using masculine pronouns.
Can you take me back to that time in your life and explain to me kind of what you were going through and how you related to your parents around it more broadly?
Well, like I said, I'd always kind of identified as something that was neither male nor female. But if we know, when you're 12, you don't really worry about it. You're just living your life. And so when I turned 18, I think it was right around then, I started having a lot more body dysphoria, just because, you know,
puberty. What was that like? What do you mean?
So body dysphoria is when you feel like the body that you are in is not a reflection of who you truly are inside. So you see yourself in the mirror or in a picture and you're like, oh, that's not me. That's not how I should look.
Do you remember having that experience at a particular moment, just like that odd disconnect that you were feeling?
Yeah, it was especially when I started realizing that however I dressed, I was still going to be observed in society as female. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't I don't like my hips. I don't like my breasts. And I need to find a way to counteract that. I wanted to present androgynously and have that space. And for 18-year-old impulsive Ahafia, testosterone was the way to go to at least try that and see if that helped. And it did. And I found a good, happy medium between them. But, I mean, it was a big thing for my family to go through, definitely. You know, my mother really treasured me as her daughter. And she still treasures me, of course, but it was just a process of me like being like, hey, mom, like I promise, like I'm not going to change. Like I'm still me. It's just that like my outward presentation is maybe not going to be exactly the same. And it was rough for a while. But I feel like all of the arguments and conversations and everything that we had around them allowed me to become closer to both of my parents because of it, like because we had to work through something like that, something that they didn't entirely know how to handle.
How was that conversation with your dad?
He was a little more accepting of it initially. He still, of course, had some reservations because he was like, well, you're my little girl. And I'm like, well, not quite. I've kind of always been somewhere in between. But he was pretty gung-ho about it, and maybe only because my mom was so opposed to it, as he kind of wanted to support me, and so they were kind of clashing, and that was a whole mess. But it was nice to get some validation from him, because he pointed out, he was like, yeah, I remember when you were going through puberty when you were like 11 or 12, and I could tell how uncomfortable you were with all of that. And I was like, oh my God, you're so right. Like, I don't even like, I just remember being uncomfortable then, but I don't remember the specifics. So it's good to get like some outside feedback from that.
In this play here that's coming up at the Unicorn, there are notes from the playwright in the mm-hmm. script, like at the very beginning, with very explicit instructions
yes.
about who should play Max, this genderqueer character. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So it's very exciting because in the script and the character descriptions, Taylor Mack specifies that it is very important to Taylor Mack that the person who plays Max be someone who is assigned female at birth and now identifies as genderqueer or trans. And this has been the only script I have so far been able to find that it is in wide circulation that calls for a canonically transgender character. And that was so exciting for me because like this is all I've always wanted to play someone like me on stage, and it was so rewarding. And the fact that I like get to do that now, it makes it so exciting to go into work every day.
Does what Max is going through in this play represent in some way on some level? I mean, clearly Max is a unique character.
Yeah.
But is there a shared experience in there that you are tapping into?
Yes, in a way. And like something that of course we have to realize is that every trans experience is a unique experience. But that being said, Max has enough shared experiences with me that it was so nice to like finally be on stage with something like that and to be able to pull from that. Like I know how it feels to have to do my testosterone shot, and I know what it feels like to be like going through the physical changes of that and having to really explain to everybody like what's happening. And my brother actually said this the first time he saw the show, is he said, wow, Hafia, like what that really felt like was like you, like in 2015 when you were on T, is like you were Max and everyone else in the room was me. And I was like, oh yeah, you are so right. Like everyone was just like going through all of this like inner turmoil of trying to figure it out. And it was never like, you know, you wanted to root for one or the other and then you changed sides. And it was like, you know, it's a lot to process.
Has playing Max given you any new insights into your own past? Just immersing yourself back in this sort of late teen experience.
Yeah. I think a little bit. what's nice about Max's character is that even though Z is the character that we would typically think of as being like the dysfunction in the family, the rest of the family is dysfunctional and Max is just trying to mediate everything. And at times, like, my experience was both of those things. Sometimes I was the center of chaos and other times I was at the middle of the chaos trying to like just fix everything around me. And I think that's what's so good about here is that it allows this trans character to just be a person rather than the problem. And that's so new. Like, you're so used to seeing trans characters and all of the drama like centering around them.
Do I understand correctly that you are by training a Shakespearean actor?
Yes. I started Camp Shakespeare at the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival when I was 8. And I did that until I was 18. And now I actually teach for them during the summers as well. I teach the camps. And until I went to college, I had never done a modern show. I had only done Shakespeare. And so it was very... it was very new for me to get into that, but I love Shakespeare.
How did gender identity come into play in your Shakespearean acting?
I very much feel like Shakespeare for me was one of the primary reasons that I felt so comfortable being myself early on. I was very lucky to grow up in this acting community that didn't necessarily care about adherence to gender roles. My teacher, Matt Rappert, was very much into casting people the way that we needed to cast them, not necessarily defined by anything. So I got to play all of these characters. Like, I went from playing Claudius in Hamlet one spring to playing Rosalind in the summer. And I played, like, Caliban in The Tempest my senior year. And so it allowed me a space of, like, gender exploration that I don't think I would have necessarily gotten from anywhere else.
Can you give me an example of how one of those characters, one of those Shakespearean characters, allowed you to explore your gender in a new way at a young age?
Rosalind, definitely. I'm very into like doing queer interpretations of Shakespeare now, just because I love giving queer voices to these plays because they're so fun and so experimental. But Rosalind especially, like being...
Explain that character for people who...
Oh, gosh. Okay, so Rosalind is this super headstrong girl who runs away with her cousin Celia and disguises herself as a boy, Ganymede, to survive in the woods and so they can travel together and be kind of safe. And then she runs into this boy, Orlando, that she loves. And she's like, I'm going to tell him that I'm going to give him lessons in how to, like, love a woman. But, like, it'll really be me the whole time. And to see that kind of gender fluidity in a character, like, even though, I mean, like, for me, she's canonically genderqueer, but like for some people, you know, it's just like a pants roll, right? But for me to like see like little baby 16-year-old me to get to play that on stage, something that I'd always felt so comfortable with and loved like playing around with, I was like, oh right, that's me.
I'm talking to Ahafia Yurkovich-Miles, who plays a genderqueer character named Max in a new play at the Unicorn. And you know, Ahafia, we started this conversation with a clip from a video you made to educate audiences on the pronouns Max uses. And you've been using those pronouns with such ease throughout this conversation. But in many ways, it is it's English, but it is a new kind of English. It's a new way of speaking English. And you make a confession in that video that the pronoun thing has been tricky even for you. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. They, them wasn't as much of a struggle for me just because I use the pronoun they, them. And they, them has really been used as the singular in English for a long time. Like Shakespeare used it. It's been used as a singular since like the 14th century. So it wasn't that hard to get used to that. But Max's pronouns, Z and here, are different alternative gendered pronouns that a lot of gender neutral, gender queer, non-binary people use. And they're just a way to get away from the gendered language of he and she a little bit. But it's new and it's hard and you're not used to it. And I remember the first time I read this play when I was like, oh my gosh, I'm really going to have to like work on this. And especially when we were in like the first couple of weeks of rehearsal, it was all of us constantly tripping over ourselves and correcting ourselves. And that's the thing, is that like all we want to do is to respect that, but it does take time. You know, it's learning a different kind of vernacular. And I think that a lot of people get nervous with alternative pronouns because they're nervous about offending someone.
Yeah,
or
they're afraid
someone.
To make a mistake.
Yeah, because misgendering people, you know, it's not great. Like, it hurts a lot of the times, but like, at least for me, when I hear people do that, like, I can always tell when people are using it to hurt me, or if they're just accidentally messing up. And I don't, you know, I can tell. I don't feel upset when I see someone trying and failing. I know that they're trying. And that's, I think, it's a great thing.
Ahafia Yurkovich-Miles, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Ahafia plays the character Max in the Unicorns production of Here through June 24th. Coming up on KCUR's Central Standard, Ed Dwight, who grew up in KCK, was almost the first Black astronaut. And we have an episode of our podcast, Midwesternish, all about that. Ed lives in Denver, but he's going to be in Kansas City as the keynote speaker in the Nelson's Juneteenth celebration. So Ed Dwight, his story, and his art are coming up. Stay tuned. Ed Dwight was always obsessed with flying, so obsessed that he used to draw birds when he was a kid. And then he started noticing that people could fly too, using airplanes. Airplanes that took off and landed at an airbase near his house in Kansas City, Kansas.
After the war started in 1941, they turned Fairfax into a training base for fighter pilots. So I got to see airplanes every day, so I started drawing airplanes.
Ed's obsession with flight would take him to the edge of the atmosphere. Well, almost. Ed never dreamed he'd go to the moon, but he did fantasize about escaping life in Kansas. And it was the idea of escape that really attracted him to those airplanes. Where were they going anyway?
The thing that I was most curious about is, so where had they been when they came to land, and where were they going when they took off? And that was the mystery, and that was my dream state and my inspiration about that they've got to be going or coming back from some exotic place that wasn't where I was. And were they being fulfilled, and what were they doing there, and every time they'd land, they'd be, you know, joyous and everything. And I think, but today, I think they're joyous because they were able to land safely. but that was my inspiration, to figure out, you know, where were they going and, you know, and where had they been.
So you can understand why he set his sights on becoming an Air Force pilot. But there was one giant obstacle standing in his way. Remember, we're talking about the 1930s and 1940s. Ed was a young Black man coming of age in the Jim Crow era.
And the idea of flying airplanes and doing all kind of wonderful things in life. And I didn't know anything about engineering and science and all that kind of stuff. So that just wasn't on the table to do that. So it was it had made some great thoughts and inspirational dreams and stuff like that, but, that was the limit of it.
Did you tell anyone about your dream?
Oh, well, everybody in town knew, that were around me knew about this dream I had. When I was out on the farm, I built an airplane out of orange crates. I would go to Safeway and get all your throwaway orange crates, and I would build these airplanes. And then when we moved downtown, I built an airplane in my backyard. And I would charge the kids a nickel to fly in it. You know, I would be in the front seat, of course. And I'd make airplane noise and all that kind of stuff. And the people in the neighborhood thought I was a screwball. But I made a lot of friends, and everybody wanted to fly in my plane.
When he wasn't building model airplanes. Ed worked delivering newspapers, the best old-timey job ever. And the front page of one of those newspapers kind of blew his mind.
And I went to pick up my papers, and on the front page was a big photograph of a black pilot standing on the wing of an F-86 Sabre jet. He had been shot down in Korea, and it was a prisoner of war, and he was from Kansas City, Missouri. And I wigged out. I said, this is insane. I didn't even know they let black pilots get anywhere near airplanes. And here this guy, and why didn't I know this? And the guy was from Kansas City. I was like, where did he get trained? How did he get in the military? How did all this stuff happen right before my nose? And so that encouraged me. When I saw that guy standing on the front of that plane, I wasn't concerned about him getting shot down. I was more rapt about the idea of him being able to fly a jet. And he had all the pilot stuff on. And so I went straight down to the recruiting office and start talking, getting literature and everything. And in the beginning, it was fun to go get the literature and stuff like that. And to the point where they threw me out and told me not to come to the recruiting office anymore. So some more time passed on. So I'd gotten out of high school. I was in college, and I was still trying to get information about how I could apply. And nobody would give me any information. So I wrote the Pentagon. And so the Pentagon sent a team to my school, and I was the first one in line. And they sent 33 of us out to Denver, Colorado, to test for pilot training. And out of the 33, I was the only one that passed.
A lot of times people say that seeing someone with your similar background or who looks like you pursuing something makes you believe it's possible. And it sounds like that really was the case for you.
Well, it was. It was, you know, if I hadn't seen Dayton Ragland on the front of that thing, I think it would have been a fascinating. I would have found out eventually, but it might have been too late. Do you see what I'm saying? Because I found out in life you have to start these things early. And one of the things, the only reason that I passed the test for pilot training, when I was a kid, my mom introduced me to the library at 4 years old, and the library was a major part of my life. So when I was like 12, 13, 14, 15, they had a whole thing on flying in the library. So I got interested in reading about this stuff. So there were 6 manuals that they had on the shelf at the Northeast Junior High School Library. And I took those manuals, I would check them out, and I would take them home, and I would read every chapter and study the chapter. At the end of each chapter was a test, a multiple choice test, and I had been doing that for years.
You were in charge of your own education.
Yeah, what happened was when I got to Denver, I sat down at the table, and they gave me these battery of tests, and I started looking at these things, and I said, I've seen this before.
Same tests?
Yeah, exactly the same tests.
Wow.
So I missed 2 questions, and in 20 minutes, I walked up. They gave you 2 hours to finish. At 20 minutes, I took them up to the guy, and he said, well, it's too tough for you, huh? I said, no, I think I maybe missed 2.
After pilot school, Ed started studying nuclear engineering in California, far from Kansas, like those planes he used to see. And then just out of the blue, a letter came in the mail.
I got this letter November 4th, 1961, asking me if I was interested in being a candidate for the first Negro ad. They were using Negro in those days. There was an opportunity to be the first Negro astronaut. Was I interested in going to test pilot school?
Who was the letter from?
It was from the Pentagon, but it was at the direction of the White House.
Under John F. Kennedy?
Yeah. And so here I thought it was a joke, obviously, you know. And I hadn't thought, going to space was not on my bucket list. That's the last thing, because I was already on the fast track, and my commanders and they told me, "See, you're going to be a general, Ed. So, just keep doing what you're doing." And so anyway, I got this letter, and I went to my media commander, and he recommended against it. And I went through all the guys, I mean, that I above me to ask him, what does this mean? And I knew about the first seven astronauts. They had been already appointed. And it was the last thing on my agenda. And all my commanders told me, you know, you don't fit in that culture, Ed. So secretly, I said my stuff in anyway.
Let's get back to Ed Dwight, who spent his childhood dreaming of taking flight like a bird or plane. Now he's a young man who's just received a letter from President John F. Kennedy, an invitation to train as an astronaut and go to the moon, which would make him one of the first men on the moon, but also the very first black astronaut, period. When we left off, Ed had just sent in his application, not really believing he'd be chosen. But amazingly enough, he got the spot. So here he is, a black man in the early 1960s entering the space program, a metaphor, if ever there was one, for American optimism. But you can't help but wonder, did he experience racism during this training?
Well, tons of it. The whole experience really broke my faith in human behavior because from the beginning, all the instructors that were to instruct me before I got down there, some of the students had already gotten down there for that particular class, and they were called in a room and told that Kennedy is trying to cram an N-word down our throats, and we cannot let that happen. So when this guy gets here, do not speak to him, do not socialize with him, do not drink with him, make life uncomfortable for him at every, and he will quit. We can't fire him because he's being placed here by the White House. We're in a carpool, that was my week to drive the carpool, you know, and nobody would speak to me. But when we got there, we all walked in 10 minutes late for the class. I was the only one that got called out in front of everybody, and I was unprofessional. There's no test pilots aren't late for meetings and class, but I was the only one singled out. And every place we went, when we were traveling, and I don't know whether this was done conspiratorially, but we'd get on the bus after we got off the plane, and they would tell, an N-word joke, and half the guys would laugh, the other half the guys had any decorum wouldn't laugh. But it was a continuum of me getting chewed out, instructors not instructing me. And we'd get up on an airplane and we'd be flying, and I'd say, am I doing anything wrong? And I would get, well, if you were doing something wrong, I'd tell you. And then they went, why did you turn that way to go back? We're finished with the flight. Why did you turn back that way? You know, and people don't do that, you know, because after every flight, everybody does acrobatics and all that other kind of stuff. But I wasn't allowed to do that. So, later on, one of my instructors was my classmate when I went into space training, and he confessed to me all of the stuff that they were. He was the one that told me about the meeting that they had. He apologized to me, for all the abuse and for chewing me out in class and all that old kind of stuff. So yeah, I when we traveled, I was the only one. Here you got a group of people in the Air Force, test pilots and future astronauts. And the hotel knows we're coming, I'd be the only one with no room.
If you're starting to get the feeling that things weren't going to turn out the way Ed hoped, you're right.
There were national politics. I mean, this wasn't something that was localized. This was, I was kind of going in and out of the White House the whole time I was there in the House and the Senate. And so there was a lot of resistance to my being, any black being in the program at that time, because they were told that if any black or woman came into this program at this early stage, the first seven astronauts would be diminished in stature. because they had to be kept as heroes, and the tax base, getting money from the citizens of America for NASA, was predicated on these seven guys that had to be made heroes, the John Glenn concept, the Neil Armstrong concept. So if you put a black in that mix, the public would say, you know, well, if a black guy can do it, if a woman can do it, these guys are not heroes. You know, these guys are just regular people. And so it was a lot of resistance on the part of the House and the Senate not to have any blacks involved in it at all. And true enough, it was 20 years almost to the day before blacks came into NASA.
This whole story kind of reminds me of John F. Kennedy's famous speech about going to the moon from 1962. He spoke about struggling to fulfill a goal.
Why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Ed Dwight chose goals too. He chose to become a pilot when everyone said he couldn't. He chose to apply for training as an astronaut, even though he'd been warned that he wouldn't be accepted. Overcoming struggles here at home can feel every bit as impossible as putting a man on the moon, until someone just goes for it, even if it's someone else who's catapulted skyward in the end. In 1983, Guy Bluford became the first black man in space. We made this Midwesternish episode about Ed Dwight, who was almost the first black astronaut, last year. Ed is also an artist, and he's the keynote speaker for the Juneteenth celebration coming up at the Nelson. He'll be joining us live to talk about his art in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we just heard about Ed Dwight, the KCK native who almost lived out John F. Kennedy's dream of sending a black man to the moon. Ed is also an artist. In fact, his sculptures are on display throughout Kansas City. It's possible you've seen them without realizing it. Ed's art is part of this year's Juneteenth celebration at the Nelson, where he'll also be the keynote speaker. And we're talking to him live from his home in Denver now. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Hello. Good morning.
It's great talking to you again. You started out drawing birds and planes and anything that flew as a kid, which eventually led to that career in engineering, airplanes, training at NASA. But it was also your start as an artist. Can you talk about your earliest years as an artist?
Well, in actuality, I think I was born to art. I started drawing when I was 2 and 3 years old. And I was kind of precocious. Mom had gotten me into a special class for training young blacks back in 1935.
Where was that class?
Yeah, it was a Keeling School, and it was an experimental program. It was kind of like a Head Start, and they were trying to determine whether. If you could start African-American kids early enough, would it make a difference in whether they excelled in school later? And so it was about 33 of us were chosen out of the neighborhoods, and I was 2 when I started, and I was doing art there, and I was a class artist in kindergarten, and I was a class artist in all through elementary school. I was a school artist through elementary school and a school artist at Bishop Ward High School.
You are a sculptor now, but that's pretty recent, right?
Yeah, I didn't start sculpting until I was 45, actually.
So you were a painter before that, and
yes.
You got a scholarship to attend the Kansas City Art Institute in 1951. You didn't go.
Yes, I did. My dad had a conference with me, you know, that Father-son conference about what are you going to do with your life, and And I told him I was going to be an artist. And I, as a matter of fact, I opened up a sign shop when I was 14. And I was in Kansas City, Kansas. I had all the churches and the pool halls and the restaurants, all that kind of stuff, and downtown stores. I was doing art.
Like hand-painted signs for all of those?
Yeah, yeah. And so my dad said, you're not going to be an artist. You're going to be an engineer. And I thought he was talking about a train engineer. I said, I don't want to drive trains. You know, he said, what are you talking about? And I said, because I didn't know what engineers did, so... But anyway, I exceeded his wishes, and I was going to go into architectural engineering because I could draw. And then later on, when I got accepted for pilot training, I changed aeronautical engineering and got a degree in aeronautical engineering.
But if you had accepted that scholarship, do I understand correctly that you would have been the first black student at the Kansas City Art Institute?
I would suggest that. I don't have any proof of that, but the way things were back in the 30s and 40s, I thought very seriously that any African-American would have been accepted at the Kansas City Art Institute for anything, because it was one of the leading institutes in the United States, actually.
Well, that would be an interesting thing to find out. We'll have to look into it. How did you keep up with your art, considering what a demanding professional life you lived? I mean, you were painting. Were you painting even during that NASA training?
I was drawing. Ironically, three of the other astronauts in training were very accomplished artists. And I found that really interesting because, it turns out, if you go to the internet today, there's a whole section on astronaut artists, and I didn't know that until later. Because we were taught a lot about cross brain activity, using both your left and right brain, and of course, art is obviously the left brain. Excellence or developing that left brain so you can do creative things but to answer your question, yes, I was always drawing and stuff on the side and my relaxation after I got out of the military, I had a huge construction company here, and I would go to my construction sites and pick up every piece of metal that was left over from that day's work and bring it home. And on the weekends, I would make art out of it. It was all the abstract art, but I would make art out of it.
What are some of the challenges you faced as a sculptor?
Well, coming on the scene, I was studying this. I didn't know anything about art. Really, I mean, the art universe. I mean, I knew how to make images, but I didn't know anything about the art universe. And so I went back to school at the age of 42 and got a degree. I got a master's degree in sculpture at the University of Denver, and I was there for 3 years, and I ended up as head of the sculpture department there for about 3 years. And so I could learn about the history of art and was there such thing as African American art, and it was an interesting study, and that there were African American artists in history and stuff, but in the larger universe, who were the real stars of African American art that were recognized by the international art universe and especially the American art universe? I mean, who were they? And because if you ask who's the most famous African American artist, I mean, you'd sculptor or painter, unless you were knowledgeable and in the and knew the history of it, you couldn't come up with a name, and that kind of bothered me a little bit, and I wondered if I became an artist, how could I shape that dynamic. Could I become can I make any money, number one, to survive? Because you have to have money to survive.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. So that was my challenge, and I ended up breaking down a lot of barriers because I ended up selling a lot of my work. I started doing Western art, which is a closed society within itself, and that kind of catapulted me because I was the only African American doing it at the time. And all of a sudden, the white audience had all this discovery. They didn't know there were black cowboys. They didn't know there were black jockeys. They didn't know there were black people of accomplishment. They had no idea.
And that's what you portrayed.
And that's what I portrayed, yeah.
Your sculpture Concerto is at the Folly, and I bet a lot of our listeners have seen it without knowing it was yours. Can you talk about it, describe it, explain what you were doing there?
Yeah, well, Miller Nichols was the driving force. I ended up coming back to Kansas City when I joined the American Royal. You know, they have that art exhibit every year, and I was and probably the first African American in the American Royal art, you know, that exhibit thing. And he kind of took a shine to me and wanted to do some exotic things, and he began to create these opportunities for me in Kansas City. And as a matter of fact, he begged me to move back to Kansas City and become his personal artist. And of course, I was all ensconced here in Denver, and I couldn't make that move without uprooting my family and stuff. So I chose not to do it, but he was the inspiration for me to come to Kansas City, and he gave me a lot of work to do. The Folly Theater opportunity came along, and he guided me through that. And I had gotten into this kind of semi-created this concept of negative space, and the Folly Theater project offered me a lot of just picking out the important aspects of imagery. You know, because some of my figures don't have bodies and they just have hands, and my Western series there'll be a guy just holding a rifle but nothing else, just his arm and a rifle and his head, and that Folly's piece gave me an opportunity to create a swooping, if you look at the thing as an undulating pen, a keyboard, with instruments attached to that, because I was fascinated with music. The Park Service had given me asked me to do a series on jazz, on the birth of jazz, and I did about 70 bronzes in that series. And being from Kansas City and being fascinated with music, and I live four blocks from where Charlie Parker grew up, and he was one of my fans, and I went to every music concert in Kansas City because I was fascinated, because I wanted to play saxophone like Charlie Parker.
You know, you will be in Kansas City for the Juneteenth celebration, as we've mentioned, at the Nelson. But as an artist who grew up here, was that museum a part of your childhood at all?
Yeah, you know, I visited that museum, and this is bizarre. I had a job on Broadway and working for KC Photo, and I was introduced to the Plaza, to Prairie Village, and I was 16 years old, and I was working for a Jewish guy by the name of Phil Borsky, and he introduced me to all kind of fascinating things. He taught me photography, number one. But I would drive all over the Plaza and the Kansas City Art Institute and Nelson Art Gallery, and I was just absolutely fascinated with that whole thing, and it had a bearing on the way I conducted the rest of my life.
Well, Ed Dwight will be the keynote speaker at the Nelson's Juneteenth celebration this Saturday, June 9th. There's a whole day's worth of festivities and programs. You can find out more about those at nelson-atkins.org. Part of the event is a guided tour of Ed Dwight's sculptures here in Kansas City. Ed Dwight, thanks so much for sharing your story.
You bet. Thank you very, very much for having me.
Today's show will be available to download or share at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all our past interviews, so you can grab anything you might have missed while you're there. kcur.org/centralstandard. Later this week, we've got lots of good stuff planned, including a Friday food show all about the vegetarian options on local menus. I wanted to tell you now so you can be thinking about what you are going to recommend when you call us. This show is produced by Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help from intern Trevor Hook. Matt Hodapp also contributed to this episode. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.